Oh, my God. Fuck me.
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima.
Ich bin ein Berliner.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this.
I can do it all day long. Don't move. Hold still.
The American people, I think, is good people. They have not to charge with the...
Oh, yes, they are in charge of the guilty Fidel.
He was being
welcome
nice.
Back.
Yes. Hey.
Welcome back to the Cold War show.
We're still here,
Ray.
Baby.
Episode 152.
Wow. That's us.
On this day of our Lord Coronavirus day, right. Something. I don't know what day it is.
Well, for me, it's...
something like that.
Yeah, but for me, it's day four, and I don't fucking know how much more I can take. Oh, my God.
Day four of the... wife and kids being home.
Leave me alone. Yes. I love them. I mean, I love them.
Yeah. To a level.
To a degree. Within a certain space. Go ahead.
Yeah. Like, I like truffles.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Tony Coniston and I, walking around Sydney the other day, went to a rooftop bar of a pub middle of the day when everyone was working, freaking out about coronavirus. Right. And we had a couple of Negronis and ate truffle burgers. But, you know, I love truffle, but I can't have too much
of it. Not every goddamn
day.
If
I have too much of it.
Right.
Yeah, I get it. Your family is like truffle.
They are. They're the truffle of my existence. We're going to leave it at that.
Well, we're recording this on the 20th of March, 2020.
Yes.
We're both still alive so far. Oh.
Sorry, to my elbow. Oh, wait, there's nobody here.
I was...
because I locked them out. Anyway.
The worst thing about traveling at the moment, yeah, I was in Sydney for the last few days because we had the second and, as it turned out, last screening of the film in Sydney. Didn't even get to have a screening in my hometown. They shut down the cinemas.
It's a conspiracy.
On the day that was supposed to. Like one more day. Right. Just like one more day, I could have done it, but no, they shut it down. But the worst thing is, you know, you often need to clear your throat, you know, like... can't do that anymore in public. That's the worst thing.
You get the look.
It's the worst thing about coronavirus. I don't care about the deaths. Or the Great Depression
it's
that we're going
judgment.
Into. It's just that
yeah.
It's the judge.
Don't judge.
You have to walk around holding it in. Yeah. Anyway. Enough of that.
Yes.
That's enough for Tommy G. Yeah. I think that's it. We've talked a little bit about family
Go
stuff.
Back
You're
to
good.
Bowling.
I'm good.
Right.
We are going to start a new mini series on the bullshit. No,
nope.
What are we doing? Cold War show
yes.
this week.
Yes.
We're going to start telling the story of Josip Broz.
Cool name.
So named because he loved his bros. Bros before hoes.
That's right.
Was
Even
his
if
model.
They're coughing.
Motto.
Exactly.
Yeah, bros before hoes. Born the 7th of May. 1892, when Columbus sailed the ocean blue.
Exactly.
Josip Broz was born on the 7th of May, 1892, or was he?
Dun, dun, dun.
Because according to the biographies I was reading of him,
all over the
no
place.
One's really
yeah,
sure.
He was a peasant. Yeah. Why? Who would care? Who would care?
Was he born then? Was he born at all? Or did he just appear?
Right.
Fully formed
right.
out of the side of a god's neck? We will maybe never know.
Well, you bring up a good point because one of the books that I was looking at reading was saying, look, everybody, you, me, Tommy G, Tito, everybody, nobody comes fully formed onto the world stage, especially if you're going to affect that world stage. You are shaped and molded by the events, good and bad, that happened to you as a child and as a teen. And as we're going to see, this guy, like all of the other influential people that we have studied throughout the years, you know, he had his good and his bad moments, but there were things that stuck with him. There were things that molded him. There were things that certainly drove him on a certain path to want to make the world, especially his country, his people, a better place, a better taking care of people, and that's going to be the same way here, we're gonna paint a picture. And so by the time we get to the end of his life or wherever we get to, it's all going to make a lot more sense because he is molded by the very events around him, just like all of us, except for Cam, who I do believe was sprung from the thigh of a deity, I think.
Now, Josip Broz, people going, who the fuck's Josip Broz? Why are we listening to this? Better known as Tito. Marshall. Now, not this Tito. Just listen.
I'm sedated. This may sound crazy, but you're all I really want to do. I swear I'm only here to have fun.
Now that would be Tito Jackson with his 2017 single Get It Baby from his debut album, believe it or not, in 2017, his debut album Tito Time.
Jermaine. I think it was Jermaine. Go ahead.
Does it matter? It's saying something, yeah. I think, Tito, yeah. That, you know, you're one of the Jackson 5. You're Michael Jackson's brother, big brother, played guitar in the Jackson 5. And it wasn't until 2017 when people said, you know what? Okay, we'll let you make an album.
It's time for a solo album, yeah. World's going to end, fuck it.
You get to make an album because you're the last Jackson alive.
Hey.
I think, yeah. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
However it happens.
Yeah. Yeah. What did I mean, I don't know. He probably had some good lines in some of those Jackson songs.
Did he? I hope he finished his tour because all touring now has stopped. So hopefully he was able to wrap that up in all four cities that he went to. I don't know.
So across more cities than you and I get to go to. Look, if you look at this, oh, here he is in his glory days. It's him playing that riff. That's Tito, man. That's Tito. But no, we're not talking. We're not talking about that Tito. Different Tito. He was named after that.
Oh, yeah.
After our Tito. Our Tito is... the guy who ruled Yugoslavia as a dictatorship for 35 years during the Cold War.
And he had six nationalities to govern, to placate, to work together. And I think generally he did a better job than most.
And despite being the leader of a communist party and a communist government... he survived 2,000 assassination attempts by Joseph Stalin.
And most people don't, right?
And may have assassinated Joseph Stalin.
Fuck me.
We told this story, I think, at some point on this show. I think we have. It's one of those things where I can't remember if we told it or we talked about it or not, but he sent Stalin a letter. Like 1952, 1953, he said, look, my friend, stop sending people to try and kill me. We've caught all of them.
Yeah.
And if you don't stop sending them, I'm going to send someone to kill you and I won't have to send a second.
Boom!
And then Stalin died like a year later.
Yeah.
And everyone's like,
Yeah. Hey, he learned.
Anyway.
So, but who knows? He was tough.
Broz was born in Kumrovets, a village in the northern region of Croatia called Hrvatsko Zagorje.
You're going to have fun with these names, aren't you?
Oh, man, we're going to have so much fun with these names, I tell you. We're going to butcher them. We're going to dismember them.
Right.
Oh, yeah. We're going to dismember.
Right, sorry.
We're going to rape, torture, and murder them like Catholics launching a crusade on other Christians that they declare heretics.
Right. Oh, my God.
His parent had a ton of kids because they were good Roman Catholics. He was the seventh of 15 children.
Ooh.
But before you think, how the hell do you raise 15 well, children? They didn't have to because 8 died in infancy. So
only
you know.
7 made it to adulthood. And like you said, his dad liked to fuck, obviously. Not the hardest worker in the world, but he made up for it by drinking.
And fucking.
And fucking. I like the mix.
Saved his energy for fucking.
Exactly. Priorities.
His father, Franjo, was a Croat whose family had lived in the same village where Josip was born for 3 centuries, while his mother, Maria, was a Slovene from the village of Podzreda, which was about 10 miles away, 16 kilometers away. So this tells you a lot straight up the bat. Yeah. Like these two, he's born from a Croat father and a Slovene mother. So he was born right into the middle of, you can imagine what that household was like. This is like, you know, an Irish, having an Irish mother and, I don't know, and a fucking British father. And, you know, just mortal enemies.
Exactly. But you, one, his, the village that he was in was near the border between Croatia and Slovenia. And you get the idea that these two got married and had all these kids. Was it a big deal? And were these people, because they're poor, they're peasants, they're just trying to get along, so no one really cares to a degree what the peasants do. Go fuck your brains out, whatever. But you get the sense that there was some tolerance in this region because everybody's just trying to get by.
Yeah, and we're going to sort of talk about over, not in this episode so much, but in the next episode, I think, we'll talk about the history of this region, because you can't understand Tito unless you understand... Right. The region, or, like the complexities of this region,
or all the Jacksons. No, sorry, different.
And their father, like
a firm taskmaster, if you will.
That's putting it mildly. Yeah. So they lived. The family lived on a small farm. They lived hand to mouth, very very poor, as you said. And Josip dropped out of school aged 13 in 1905, worked on the family farm for a while. His father wanted him to emigrate to the USA, but they couldn't raise the money. So instead, he ended up working as an apprentice to a Czech locksmith. It wasn't just a locksmith. He said did locks, but he also did like mechanical stuff, repairs, all that kind of stuff.
I do want to throw in real quick, before he did that, he was a waiter. He goes to the relatively big town of Siskat in central Croatia. He becomes a waiter, and a part of his job is he has to wear this uniform. And like you said a second ago, dirt poor, sometimes they did without. It was fortunate for them that some of the kids died because they couldn't afford to feed them all. But from this job as a waiter, even though he only had it for a short time, he loved the fancy uniform, which is going to inspire over the decades, pretty much the rest of his life, this love of suits, of dressing up, of looking sharp, because he's going to be fancy Dapper Dan for many years to come, unless he has to truly go undercover. So he goes from poverty to this fancy waiter uniform, loves suits, and then you're right, he becomes an apprentice to a locksmith, and he's there for 3 years. He's relatively well-fed compared to his childhood. He has a bit of money, and as we're going to see, just like all the other people that we've discussed over the years, Hitler, Mussolini, Stalin, Alexander, Caesar, he compensates for his lack of an education by being a voracious reader for the next couple of decades. When he gets some extra money, he either buys or borrows or whatever books, and he tries to really make up for the education that he could not get because he had to work to help the family out.
You know what that's called when you compensate for a lack of education by becoming a voracious reader?
No, what's that?
It's called doing a cam. Doing a cam. When I was in Melbourne last week, I went to the South Melbourne markets with my son, Taylor, and his business partner, Lockie. And I showed them the secondhand bookstore in the markets that's still there. Did I take you there? I did. I took you to the South Melbourne markets, I think. And I showed you the bookstore, right? The famous bookstore?
Yeah, and then we had some kebabs or lamb or something.
No, that was at the Vic markets.
Vic Mark,
we had the lamb. There we had donuts, I think, at the South Melbourne market if we went there. That's the classic. Donuts and the other classic thing to get there is the Chinese balls. What do you call it? Forget it. Anyway,
right.
It's too early.
It is.
But yeah, there's a second-hand bookstore there. Still there, called the Merchant of Fairness. He's always called himself Secondhand Bookstore.
I like that.
When I was like 18, 19, I worked, had a shitty job at Ford Credit as a debt collector near the South Melbourne markets. And every day I'd go there, walk around on my lunch break, go to see Rod, who's still there, still owns this place.
Wow.
And I would say, Rod, what should I read this week? And he'd go, well, yeah, what do you know about Napoleon? What do you know about this guy? What are you going to know? Nothing. He'd go, okay, take this. He'd go through his biography section and he'd grab me two or three biographies, and they were like a buck, secondhand right. books. Awesome. And because I couldn't afford new books, I was sure. poor as shit, like Josip was. And he would just give me these books. Go read that. I'd read it for a week, come back, go, great, what's next? I guess, okay, well, what about Ayn Rand? You ever read Ayn Rand? No. Okay, great. Read the Fountainhead. And he just gave me, he was my university education. He right. just gave me books. He sold them to me for right. a buck or two each.
Still.
And I bought, no lie, I reckon probably 800 books from him over the next 10 years. Yeah. I just, even when I stopped working there, I'd go there every weekend and just go, okay, yeah. what do you got for me? I built this massive library based on him sort of handing me stuff. Yeah.
No. So instead of hundreds of thousands of dollars at a university, maybe a couple thousand or a couple hundred, whatever, at this bookstore. My favorite part of the story is the second half that you told me, where you took your son and you told him about that. And he goes, what did he say? Something like, when did I ask, or when did I pretend to care, Dad? Why are you telling me this? Typical.
When? Just when? I go, when? 30 years ago. He goes, no, when? Well, what do you mean when? When did I tell you I gave a fuck about your fucking stories?
See, the younger generation. Fuck, yeah. Anyway.
But, and I think I obviously told you this story, so I apologize. People have heard it, but fuck them. So when I was shooting the film at South Melbourne Markets last year, I tried to go and get him on camera. I really wanted to get him on camera.
Right.
To honor the role. But, you know, here's the thing. Like, you don't understand, like, everything that I do today, the podcasts, the book, the film, is all because of that guy. One guy, probably, I've seen him over the years. He goes, oh, Cameron, how you doing? His name's Rod Cameron, actually, which is why he can always remember my name. He goes, oh, Cameron, how you doing? Like, he met me when I was 18. I'm now nearly 50. But I've said this to him, and he goes, oh, that's nice. But I was like, everything I do, my entire life. And I went back there the other day to say, hey, I got a documentary on in Melbourne tonight. I want you to come, free ticket. You're a guest of honour. Right. Because none of this would have happened without you
being an influence,
selling books to me.
Exactly.
I mean, that's his job, selling books. But he was, but you know, he curated.
He could have given you comic books. He could have given you, whatever.
I remember he gave me Nixon's memoirs, Ayn Rand, like everything, left, right, middle, everything. You know, read this, read that.
We all need that. You should have went up to him. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you don't know
exactly
the impact that you're going to have on people's lives. Right. Just a kind word, a kind thought, D-back, don't be a coronavirus. And over the years, you know, that can go a long way.
Yeah, you should have went up to him and look, I'm kind of a big deal, and I just want to thank you. I just want to thank you for that.
Look, there's 12 people around the world today who think really, I'm a big deal.
Right. So
on their behalf.
Mm. But this guy is going to have to do for himself what Cameron did for you, Rob did for you, because he's going to be all over different parts of the world, and he's still going to not let that stop him, and he's going to consume books whenever he can.
And some of the books he starts reading this age, around about 18, is socialist literature.
Mm.
Because at 18, he finishes his apprenticeship, he joins the Metal Workers Union,
right.
starts working in factories, and he's a labor guy, and he participates in his first labor protest. He joins the Social Democratic Party of Croatia and Slavonia. Mm-hmm. This is around about 1910. Yeah. So he starts getting involved in the workers' movement. Now, keeping in mind, this is early part of the 20th century. It's 7 years before the Russian Revolution. It's 4 years before World War One, and he, you know, there's this big movement around the world of the international workers trying to figure out how they get more rights for the workers. Capitalists are just, there's no curbs on capitalists anywhere in the world, whether it's Croatia or the United States or Australia or England. People could do whatever the fuck they want. You got money. You can just force your workers to work 25 hours a day, 8 days a week, and no one's going to do fucking anything about it. You can have your workers. You can shoot one of your workers on Fifth Avenue, and you'd still get elected president. Yeah,
just give the president, just to give the police a $20 bill, whatever. But I did want to ask you this real quick. So he grows up dirt poor. There are times they do without. He gets this, for him, you know, relatively speaking, a decent paying job. He can actually afford to purchase books. And for him, life has never been better. Yes, I'm sure he's working very hard. But it turns out that he has a natural gift as a locksmith, or as he's very mechanically inclined. So he is doing relatively well, certainly better than his father did, but yet he can see the drudgery around him. He can see that the people are being exploited. He doesn't have to care, but I think it's part of his makeup that he sees the people are suffering and they want more and they're being treated like crap. And so he does care and he wants to be a part of something that's going to solve some of these problems.
Well, yes, but I'm sure there's a certain amount of self-interest in it. I mean, over the next few years, he moved around a lot looking for work. It's not like, you know, he was living in a mansion at this stage. He was doing better than he had done, but he's still poor. He still wanted to be able to build a life for himself.
Sure, but the point I'm trying to make is because of his skill, he can travel. He travels to Italy, to Germany, to Munich, to Vienna. Because he's got the skill set, he can afford to move around. He's going to be wanted. He might be treated like crap, but it's not like he's a ditch digger or something who probably couldn't even afford to travel to look around. So he travels around Europe. He expands his horizons. He learns, because this guy is just a brainy cove, he learns to speak German fluently. He learns to speak Czech on his travels. He's becoming a better engineer. He's reading more books. And so this guy he's got potential, even if he didn't recognize it at first. But through all these different jobs and these traveling, he is really developing himself. He's seen more of the world. And he's seen that it could be better. As good as it is for him, it's still pretty crappy, like you said. And it could be better if people were treated decently.
Yeah, I didn't get the impression that he was traveling for fun, though. I got the impression that he was traveling because he was looking for work. He had to go to places that had healthier economies at that stage than Croatia did. Anyway, yeah, he gets jobs everywhere he goes because, as you say, he seems to have a natural gift for mechanical stuff. He's got jobs fixing bicycles. He works in auto factories, including at the Benz car factory in Mannheim.
Right.
He works for Austro Daimler, was often asked to test drive the cars.
Nice.
And also during this time, he spends a lot of time fencing, becomes a master fencer, not like backyard fencing, but like touche, on guard fencing, and dancing.
Right.
Fencer and a dancer, because the two main qualities that you need to be a dictator of an Eastern country is good at fencing and dancing. They're the two key things, and he knew that then. He goes, one day I'm going to be a dictator and need to be able to dance.
It's my way into their hearts. And not unlike his father, he is going to become a bit of a womanizer, and the dancing part probably helped.
I mean, to be fair,
right?
When you spend your days, when he wasn't fixing bicycles, he spent his days doing this. I mean, how can you not dance when you're doing when that's going on in the background?
I jumped up just now. I was dancing. Yeah.
Did you have pants on?
Yeah. I don't have to answer those questions.
And in May 1913,
right, age 21,
he was scripted into the Oscar-Jagugan. Does coronavirus make you lose your powers of speech? Is that one of the symptoms?
By the tongue. Not by the balls, but by the tongue.
The Austro-Hungarian army for his 2 years of compulsory service.
And I'm imagining because of where he's from, because he was born in that empire where they are second-class citizens, he and his Croat comrades, if you will, are not too happy about this.
Well, I think, as we'll see in our next episode, mm-hmm. As you say, the Croats, the Serbs, all treated fairly shabbily by the Austro-Hungarian. Basically, if you weren't from the Austro part or the Hungarian part, yeah, you were not...
cannon fodder.
Yeah. But he must have shown some talent for leadership because he was sent to a school for non-commissioned officers in Budapest.
Nice.
And then he was promoted to sergeant major. So even though he came from this poor background in the backwaters of the empire, mm-hmm. and he's a Croat slash Serb, I guess, by birth, they go, yeah, this guy's got some talent.
That's right.
At 22, he was a sergeant major, and according to some sources, he was the youngest person to ever achieve that rank in his regiment.
Right. Well, I think his work ethic from when he was young, even something like this, if you're going to do it well. I mean, you had to work hard as a child to survive. When he was the apprentice, he had to do well or he would have been thrown out because it really was a privilege for him to be there to learn that skill. I think he's learned if you're going to do it well, and that will benefit you either now or in the future.
Well, yes, but leadership is more than just hard work, I think.
That's true.
Have to have a talent for commanding respect, understanding humans, understanding what you need to say to each person to get them to do. Right. Like, I obviously am a very poor leader because I spent 6 years trying to get you to do shit, and it's got me nowhere.
It's not you, Cam. It's me. Trust me.
Yeah, paying you money to turn up. That's all it is. That's the only form of motivation.
Set your bar low and everybody will be better off. But no, you don't. So here we are.
I keep expecting, better things of you and getting disappointed.
I've read the right book this time mostly.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, we got off of... that's a step. It's a step in the right direction. I said before that he was the youngest of that rank in his regiment. At least one source I read states he was the youngest sergeant major ever in the Austro... Why am I struggling to say this? The Austro-Hungarian Army. The youngest person to ever achieve sergeant major rank. Now, but again, I want to point out that a lot of the stuff that we know about him is kind of probably propaganda that he came up with during his years of rule. In terms of getting, good quality biographical information, it's still a little bit dicey.
Yeah.
Now, then he won the regimental fencing competition.
Nice.
And came in second in the Army Fencing Championships in Budapest in May of 1914.
So this guy's got some game.
He's no slouch.
Right.
Younger sergeant major in history, second best fencer in the entire Army. And he's only like 23 at this stage.
He's a cunning linguist, a swordsman, a dancer, mechanically inclined, and as you were hinting at a second ago, that we're going to find out later, it turns out that his various set of skills, he is a natural-born leader. He knows how. He's a people person. He knows how to work with people, and when you throw in the fact that he can speak all these different languages and communicate effectively and efficiently with his people, he's going to rise to the top because that just seems to be who he is.
I'm a cunning linguist.
You are.
Now, soon after World War I broke out in 1914, his regiment, the 25th Croatian Home Guard Regiment, was sent towards the Serbian border, and then he got arrested for sedition and imprisoned in the Petrovaradin Fortress near the Novi Sad, the current Novi Sad. Now, he himself gave different accounts of why he got arrested.
Huh.
He told one biographer that he had talked about deserting to the Russians. He's like, we're all fucked. This is fucked. I'm going to the Russians. He told another biographer, oh, no, it was all a big mistake. It was a clerical error.
Yeah.
They were supposed to arrest Josip Braz, not Josip Broz, and it was all a big misunderstanding. Right. So there was a third version that somebody overheard him saying that he hoped the Austro-Hungarian Empire would be defeated, and he got arrested for that. Because we have to point out that, again, the Croatians and the Serbs had no love. I mean, they were, woo, Austro-Hungarian Empire, you rock! They're like, fuck you guys, you're Arab. They're like the Jews in Judea and the Austro-Hungarians are the Romans. I mean, they're
right.
They didn't willingly put up their hand and say, you know, can we join?
Pick me.
Yeah, it's not like a country joining NATO or voting to be made part of the United States. It's no. They were forced into the empire at the point of a bayonet.
Right, and they were fighting against the Russians, who generally, as we'll go into the next episode, were the protectors of that region, of the Slavs of that region. So they're literally fighting for the people they don't like and fighting against the people that they do like. I mean, how could you not be bitter? And if you have a couple of drinks, yeah, you're going to start saying some shit that you probably shouldn't.
Although he's a Catholic and the Russians are Orthodox, and as we'll see in the next episode, a lot of the tensions in this area come down to religion.
Fucking
but he had maybe some kind of affinity with the Russians and their struggle.
Right.
Now, after he was acquitted and released, he went back to his regiment, served for a little while on the Serbian front, ended up getting deployed to the Eastern Front in World War I in Galicia about early 1915, where he had to fight against Russia. Yeah. Now, it gets a little bit murky here. In his own account, he didn't mention that he participated in the failed Austrian invasion of Serbia, giving the impression he only fought in Galicia.
Right.
Because it would have been sort of offensive to the Serbians, who he ruled over, to know that he had fought for the Habsburgs against them in 1914. But we do know that sort of happened. Apparently, there's other evidence of that. Galicia, by the way, is sort of Eastern Europe region, once part of Austria-Hungary. Goes way back, settled by the Gauls.
Right.
Huh. You know, it's where people that are familiar with the Bible will know that there's one of Paul's epistles, the letter to the Galatians.
Right.
I did want to ask. Yeah.
Did you read where he gets recorded that he and kind of his the men around him were good at going behind the lines, getting information, capturing prisoners? I wonder if that was more post-spin versus his true talents, because, again, that would have been risky as well. But you never really know it's true, because obviously when this story gets told years later, he has to be careful about what he says. But it's hard to tell.
Yeah, no, well, in 1980, he died in 1980, and after he died, when they had access to archives that got opened up, they apparently found that he was recommended for an award for gallantry and initiative for reconnaissance and capturing prisoners. And the story that he had told is that he commanded a scout platoon that went behind enemy lines in World War One, captured 80 Russian soldiers and brought them back across the lines.
Yeah, you don't want that getting out.
Hey, it was a war. It was a war.
That's true, but still.
Now, one of the biographies that I read by Richard West, he wrote that Tito actually downplayed his military record.
Right.
The Austrian army records show that he was a brave soldier and, you know, fought bravely and was very loyal to the Habsburgs, et cetera, et cetera. But, he didn't want to portray himself as that. He liked to portray himself as a bit of a rebel.
right.
who hated the Austro-Hungarian Empire, etc., etc. But as it turns out, according to Richard West anyway, he took to it with gusto.
Mm.
Like, a bit like, it reminds me of Napoleon, you know, in the early part of Napoleon's career, he was fighting for the Bourbon monarchy when he was a soldier before the revolution. Then, you know, he switched sides a number of times. Like, he switched sides to go to Corsica and fought against the French when he was part of the Corsican rebellion. And then when that failed and he got kicked out, he and his brothers got kicked out of Corsica, he went, oh, no, I'm French. Oh, no, really. I'm on this side. Like, he's switching sides. Opportunist.
No, I was spying for you. You're welcome. He's an opportunist. What's wrong with that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it just the way that he portrayed himself, you know, later on in life was that I never really liked those Austro-Hungarians. But really, as you said, he was a hard worker. He was industrious. He actually probably fought well for them. As I said, he was recommended for an award.
Yeah.
Anyway, he was regarded, according to Richard West, by his fellow soldiers as Kaiser true. True to the emperor.
Oh, nice.
He was a true believer, according to the records of the army in those early days.
Yeah, they don't just give those to anybody. Yeah.
Then he got stabbed in the back, literally.
Now, what year, when do you have that happening? Because I have the
spring. 25th of March, 1915.
Okay, so yeah, so spring of 1915, he gets stabbed with a lance just below the left arm. Now, I guess, I'm not sure I can explain this, but he gets taken to Kazan on the Volga, which is 500 miles east of Moscow. So he is taken deep into Russian territory, and he's going to be in a hospital for just over a year. I mean, this is a serious wound, almost like Alexander with the arrow in the lung kind of thing. This is going to take some time for him to get over with. But again, because he's there for a year, and again, because he's a cunning linguist, he's actually going to pick up another language, Russian, which he is going to learn how to speak fluently. This guy is a talent.
Yeah, but his own account of this event, he describes it like this. He was defending an attack. He says, but suddenly the right flank yielded and through the gap poured cavalry of the Circassians from Asiatic Russia. Before we knew it, they were thundering through our positions, leaping from their horses and throwing themselves into our trenches with lances lowered. One of them rammed his 2-yard iron-tipped double-pronged lance into my back below the left arm.
Yeah.
I fainted. Then, as I learned, the Circassians began to butcher the wounded, even slashing them with their knives. Fortunately, Russian infantry reached the positions and put an end to the orgy.
Gotcha. Damn. Saved by
now, I got a little bit turned on there. I don't know about you.
Thrusting, are you kidding me?
Thrusting, hard tipped, orgy.
No mercy. anyway.
So, yes, he becomes a Russian prisoner of war and he's there for over a year. 13 months he's in hospital. He gets secondary illnesses, pneumonia and typhus, and learned Russian, talking about getting turned on, learned Russian with the help of 2 schoolgirls.
I could learn anything during a threesome.
Who brought him Russian books by Tolstoy and Turgenev and people like that.
Damn.
So, yeah, like, I'm just like, Russian schoolgirls coming every day.
.com. Oh, my God. Yeah. but more than that.
No, well, listen.
Yeah.
Listen, you know, call me crazy, call me stupid, but that is like, we hear a lot in our Cold War episodes about cunning communist plots.
Right.
That is the way. Like, forget.
Good point.
Putin doing, like, Vlad, I know you love the show, Vlad. I know Vlad's a big fan, Vladimir Putin.
Mr. Bean.
Forget all this, you know, into the internet spying, research agency and the all the fake news and all that kind of stuff. Listen, if you want to convert us all, just send two Russian schoolgirls to our homes to quote unquote teach Russian. We're all gonna.
I'll meet you halfway.
We're all gonna convert. Well, I'll become a communist. I know, technically, Vlad, you're not a communist anymore.
Come on.
But, you know.
Whatever you want.
Yeah, but come on. Yeah, listen, just send the Russian schoolgirls. Right. Well, I'll become whatever you want, quite frankly.
Yes.
I mean,
yes, comrade.
You just tell me. Yeah. Just tell me. Send two Russian schoolgirls to teach me Russian.
Done and done. If actually that could be their names. Done and done. But, so. Besides these weighty tomes, besides the language, he actually does look around and he sees that, one, these are fellow Slavs like him. We don't have to go into all that, but they're ethnically connected. And two, he's seen that these people are commoners. They're not very happy with their current system of government, the Tsar, and they're not happy either. So again, he's digging the vibe of what these people who want to rise up and free themselves from tyranny. And the two scrolls.
I think you're getting the whole Slav thing confused. What happened is the two schoolgirls turned up and he said, you got a little Slav in you? They said, no. He said, nyet. He said, would you like some?
Ba-dum-boom. They said, da? All right.
He caught typhus from his lice-ridden fellow patients. So finally, in May 1916, he's recovered. He's well enough to leave hospital. Unfortunately, he didn't get to take Dunn and Dunn with him. They had other work to do.
Right.
Their mission was not over. Yeah, they had to convert more people.
They're busy. Yeah.
And he went south to a place called Ardatov near Samara, which is now in the province of Kubyshev.
Nice.
And got work as a mechanic in a mill.
Yeah, it's a skill
then,
set. He's good at it.
A few months later, near the end of 1916, he was put in charge of a gang of other prisoners, because he's still a prisoner, right?
Right, right.
He didn't get let out of hospital. You're free to go. He's a prisoner of war.
Yeah.
He's put in charge of a gang of other prisoners who were working on the Trans-Siberian Railway.
Yeah. But what does it say about him? It's like, okay, look, you're all prisoners, but you, I don't know, there's something special about you. I'm going to put you in charge of all the other prisoners. Again, I don't know if it was that leadership or people he got along with people. I don't know, but someone must have noticed some talent and boom, maybe he was the best engineer there. Who knows? But he's even going to be the leader of the prisoners. He's tapped for that position.
Yeah, speaking of the Trans-Siberian Railway, bucket list, right? I really want to ride the Trans-Siberian Railway.
That would
all
be
the way from Moscow to Vladivostok.
With the two Russian girls. Sorry.
You just rock up and you're like, they're stamping your ticket when you're getting on. You're like, where are they?
Where's Dunn and Dunn?
Where's my two Russian schoolgirls? I thought everyone who comes here gets two. Right. Isn't that the?
I paid extra.
Cam and Ray told me that was the deal. You get.
I want to talk to your manager now. I am most displeased.
I want them back. Where's my two Russian schoolgirls? Dunn and Dunn's their name.
Or their stage name, at least. Come on, you know what I'm talking about, right? You do have to take the train from Edinburgh to Inverness. That train ride is absolutely magical. I swear to God, it was incredible. So I would love to do that one as well. Obviously, it's a lot longer.
I've never been to Scotland, and my plan, like Tony Coniston keeps going to, he does like this single malt distillery tour every other year,
of course he does.
I've got to convince him to take me next time. He offered to take me last time. He went like last year with his mate. Yeah, Mark,
near me, the same time I did.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
He offered to take me then, but I said, some of us have to fucking work, motherfucker, but...
that's probably why he didn't go. He said, if you're going to hurt my feelings, then forget it.
March of 1917, he kind of gets arrested again. I mean, he's already a prisoner. I don't know what's going on, but... some sort of offence, and he's I guess he's in jail again. He's not allowed to work on the railway. They've got him locked up for something. He told somebody to go fuck themselves. I don't know what's going on. When I'm reading this, I keep thinking of Paul Newman in what's his movie where he's arrested? The Cold Hand Luke.
Right.
I keep thinking of, his attitude in Cold Hand Luke, where he just keeps talking back to the guy. What we have here is failure to communicate. Here we go. I got to play that now. Mr. Honeycutt. Paul Newman's getting dragged out of a car, beaten, dirty, in handcuffs. Oh, they're putting cuffs on his ankles.
You're going to get used to wearing them chains after a while, Luke. Don't you never stop listening to them clinking. They're gonna remind you of what I've been saying. For your own good.
I wish you'd stop being so good to me, Captain.
Don't you ever talk that way to me. Never! Never!
Just beat him with a bludgeon.
Damn.
What we've got here is failure to communicate. Some men... you just can't reach. I don't like it any more than you, man.
Mmm. Oh, great film. Strother Martin playing Captain there. Me too. I got to watch that again. Oh, man. I think it's time for a Paul Newman movie night, man. I got to just sit there and watch all Paul Newman's movies. But this guy, Strother Martin, died in 1980, same year as Tito. No coincidence in that whatsoever.
Right.
Born in Kokomo. He's born in Kokomo, but a friend. I got to take a friend. I don't know what that fucking song was.
Kokomo.
It's in Kokomo, Indiana, man.
Oh, okay, that makes sense. All right.
He was in Cool Hand Luke, also Slapshot, another Paul Newman movie, The Wild Bunch, True Grit.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, man. Gunsmoke. He's in Gunsmoke. Rooster Cogburn. Beretta. Up in Smoke, even.
Oh, nice.
What a career. This guy was in Bonanza. Everyone was in Bonanza and Gunsmoke, pretty much. Clint Eastwood, I think, was in Gunsmoke. Everyone was in those things. Yeah. The Virginian. Basically, a Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. All of Quentin Tarantino's favorite TV shows and films, basically, Strother Martin was in. If he had been around, if he'd survived another 10 or 11 years, no doubt Quentin would have put him in Reservoir Dogs. He's that great. What we have here... is failure, not a failure, but failure is failure. You know who else was, just for the kids who have never seen Cool Hand Luke, who else is in it? Dennis Hopper's in it.
Really?
Harry Dean Stanton is in it.
Damn.
Just a great fucking cast. George Kennedy, of course, is in it. Just a classic. Years.
Okay, we'll both watch it at the same time. And speaking
Speaking of great films from the 60s and 70s, fucking Tony Coniston just ruined my day yesterday. No, day before yesterday. Right. We're sitting in this rooftop bar eating truffle burgers, drinking Negronis, and he told me that Burt Reynolds was gay.
You son of a bitch.
Did you know that? I told Chrissy over this today. She goes, well, duh. I'm like, what do you mean? She goes, the mustache. I'm like, come on, that's the manliest mustache.
That makes him a porn star, not gay. Come on.
Yeah. You know, she reckons, he reckons, Gabe, he apparently read a biography or autobiography on Bert. Bert's best friend, apparently his whole life, was Charles Nelson Reilly.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know him?
Yeah, love him.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, gay as a, you know...
right.
Row of gay things. I don't know.
Oh, lined up. Right.
Non-Americans not familiar with him, this is what he sounds like, Charles Nelson Reilly.
And Charles, we're delighted that you're back. What's that?
No, it's for Richard. Richard...
He's busy right now. Take a message.
Richard.
We're not leaving the show, but well, what the heck?
Yes, Alan, everything I told you in New York is true.
Bye. Like, fabulously, you know, fabulous.
Just fabulous.
Gay guy.
Right.
His name's. Yeah, apparently he and Bert were, apparently, according to Tony Connison's my only source here. But apparently, you know, Burt Reynolds used to like buy Charles Nelson Reilly houses and give him cars and all this kind of stuff. Damn. Now, Tony Coniston, you know, looks after me a lot too, and we're not gay yet. But
I want to believe you.
Who knows what could happen if we get to Vegas at some time.
Your old stomping ground.
How did I get onto this? Anyway, oh yeah, he's in jail.
Right.
What are we doing? What? He's in jail again in 1917, and he gets news that revolution has broken out in Russia, in Petrograd, where been based, and in Moscow. And from his cell, he can hear the crowd outside shouting, "Down with the Tsar."
Ooh, this shit's real. It's really happening, and he's right there. And like the Tsar abdicates,
I've actually got a recording of that.
I don't doubt it.
Get off Spotify, Fox!
A short time ago.
Fuck hell. Fox is on his iPad. Why aren't you at school? It's 9:30 in the morning.
Corona?
You are. I'm trying to play something. Stay off it for a minute. Go to school. Leave me alone.
Don't try to out-yell him. Come on.
Fucking hell, he did it again. God damn it.
I don't feel so bad now.
The problem is?
Right?
The problem with Fox is?
Yes.
What here is failure to communicate.
God damn it.
I pissed myself.
Down with the king for years, about 10 of them. Recruiting suckers, making men of them. Tears of fears for my peers, they ripping. You think that it is, if not it isn't. Race for the border, my daughter, cause beats you banging out. Jeeps rocking beats in the streets of the town for hanging out. Gather, or rather form a circle around aloud, cause brothers or others could never ever rock a crowd. Is it because he's running off with the mouth, or was he really clearly trying to play a nigga out? Nope, shut him down, the king with the crown, cause all you wanna be is dicky down, down with the king. Yeah. Oh yeah. Still got it, man.
Yes, you do. Never lost it. Take a smoky break.
And as you can imagine, you're in your prison. You're hearing that.
Yeah.
You're getting excited. That's very exciting shit. Yeah. Very exciting.
Call me
so he learned that the Tsar had abdicated and a provisional government had been established. And in the years he'd been in Russia, it developed a sympathy for the plight of the working class there. As you said, they were Slavs. He's a Slav.
Mm-hmm.
They had a little bit more Slav in them after he had finished with them. But, you know, they... He was working class, a factory worker, had no sympathy for the aristocracy or the capitalists. Even though, according to his, fellow soldiers, he was, Kaisertruh. You know, really? Maybe he pretended to be that. Anyway, once he got out of jail, he joined the revolutionaries, the Russian revolutionaries, fighting the Russian revolution.
So, yeah, there's the revolution, there's the moderates, and there's the extremists like the Bolsheviks. And because of his sympathy with these people, he joins the extremists, he joins the Bolsheviks.
Now, I don't think we need to explain this again. I mean, if you're a new listener and you haven't gone back and listened to our early episodes from years ago, shame on you. Yeah. What the fuck are you doing? Go back and listen. But, of course, when the Russian Revolution broke out, it was mostly the moderates that ended up taking control, the Mensheviks, as they ended up being known as. And he sided with the Bolsheviks, which got him arrested again. I mean, the provisional government didn't really care about prisoners of war so much because it wasn't their war. One of the reasons the revolution happened in 1917 is because the masses didn't want to be in the war, not our war. We don't care about your colonial war. Archduke, who? Don't give a fuck. Why are we in this thing? We're all just getting killed and we're not going to get anything out of it. It's not like we're going to see any booty at the end of this. It's not like this is a crusade and you're going to give us an indulgence against all sins at the end of this.
Good old days.
We're just cannon fodder.
No taxes.
Trench fodder. No, thank you very much. But the provisional government didn't like it when you were A, foreigner, B, prisoner of war, B, you side with the Bolsheviks. But he wasn't in jail for long. He had a friend that he'd worked with in a factory who got him released and helped him get a job in Petrograd. So now he's a free man for the first time in years, and he gets a job in Petrograd. So he travels there by hiding on a train for several days amongst sacks of grain on a goods train with a bunch of rats and whatever else. Now, at the time, of course, all the Bolshevik leaders were still overseas. Again, we've talked about this on earlier episodes, but when literally the night before the revolution happened, Lenin was giving a speech in Switzerland somewhere, and he said, the revolution's probably not going to happen in my lifetime. Right. And that's why Tony Kynaston says, I don't believe in forecasting, because
you never know.
If even Lenin didn't know when the revolution was going to happen, then what hope has anyone got of knowing anything? Revolution was spontaneous. People just said, you know what, fuck this shit, and sat down and said, we just went on strikes. Yeah. And then they said, send in the army. And the army went, you know what, we're with them. You. No, fuck this shit. This is crazy. Yeah. Send in the police. The police were like, yeah, you know what? Fuck you.
Ditto.
So Marie Antoinette. No, that's the wrong revolution. So they, the Bolshevik leaders soon got back, though. Germans let Lenin travel through their territory to get back. They figured better to have Lenin running things over there. Mm. And he said, look, first thing I'm going to do when I get back is end the war. You know, and they go, well, they're already doing that. And he goes, well, I'm really going to do that. Then Trotsky and Zinoviev and Stalin, all these guys managed to get back. They'd all been in exile. Mm-hmm. And then they start, as the Bolshevik leaders, they started to organize mass demonstrations against the provisional government.
Right. They need drama. They need confusion. Yeah.
Well, yes, but they had differences, even though, I mean, the provisional government wasn't all made up of Mensheviks. It was made up of, you know, various different members of the elite.
Yeah.
It's like the Russian Revolution was made up of sort of the petty bourgeoisie who were trying to take control, but the socialists wanted it to be a workers' revolution, not a revolution of the rich white guys. Again, that's not a real revolution.
We trade one rich white guy for another one. Fuck that. We're trying to do the real thing here.
And the Mensheviks were like, well, listen, we agree. We want it to be a workers' revolution, but let's do it slowly, non-violently. Yeah. Let's just, we can work with these guys, and then eventually we'll educate the people and we'll have some elections and we'll vote them out and vote us in. Yeah. And the Bolsheviks were like, no, fuck that shit. Let's just get it done now. Now is the time.
Right. Yeah.
So they started to organise mass demonstrations. Demonstrations led to riots. Riots led to the provisional government sending in the troops to shoot and kill demonstrators and arresting lots of Bolsheviks, including Josip Broz, who was in a demonstration on a march against a railway station that came under machine gun fire. Lots of people died, mass arrests, and he didn't get arrested. He went on the run.
I thought he was arrested and was being sent to a jail in Serbia, but he escaped. Is that not...
That's after this.
Oh, sorry.
So he lived on the streets for a while.
Ooh.
His flatmate, the guy that got him out of jail and sent him to work for his son, so he's living with this kid, like the guy's son. He's living with another young guy who's also a Bolshevik. His flatmate gets arrested. So Broz, they know where these guys live, so Broz can't go back to his apartment. So he lives on the streets, lives under bridges, has to suck a few dicks, eat a few, rats, the usual thing. You're very familiar with that. You've been there. Yeah, what we call the Walmart days of Ray's life.
You don't want to know the dicks and the rats. Anyway.
Trying to avoid the authorities, and he tries to make his way to Finland, but gets arrested on the border. Somehow, they've got the word out. They know who he is. He gets sent back to Petrograd and thrown into a rat-infested fortress dungeon called St. Peter and Paul on an island. Now, if you're going to – when you're naming dungeons – naming them after St. Peter and Paul, I think, is the way to go. Now, I don't know if you've... Did you have a chance to look into the Peter and Paul fortress in St. Petersburg?
No, is there a sex dungeon? No, tell me.
Today it's a sex dungeon. Oh, yeah, you can go there couple of Russian schoolgirls. They have a replica of an old bridge there with some homeless guys underneath it. You can suck their dicks if you want. They cater for everything.
They got everything.
No, it was originally built by Peter the Great in 1703, and it's a star fortress.
Star-shaped.
Okay. Kind of, like a rough star. Like it's got little pointy bits coming out of it everywhere so you can, defend it better.
Sure.
Fabulous. Look, I think it's on an island just off St. Petersburg, like a tiny little island. It's basically just a fortress. It's this little island that's just 100% fortress. Today it's the State Museum of St. Petersburg history.
Damn, that's intense.
But it was a brutal jail. A lot of famous people were sent there. The first person to escape from it was Prince Peter Kropotkin, the famous anarchist. Other people who were sent there, Dostoevsky was sent there, Maxim Gorky, Bakunin, Trotsky, and of course Tito. A lot of famous people.
Yeah.
If you were anyone in Russia, I want to be sent to that jail.
Don't you know who I am? I need to go there.
He gets sent to the dungeon of Peter and Paul. Now, but at this stage, he could talk fluent Russian, and he's a Slav.
Right.
And at first, the prison guards there refused to believe he was even a foreigner. But eventually they believed him, and he was sent under guard to a camp in Siberia.
Damn. I guess he convinced him.
Yeah, but showing his MacGyver brand of engineer, JB, Josip Broz actually stood for James Bond, Tito. When the train stops to take on more people, he asked his guard for permission to get some water to make tea.
Oh, come on.
They said, sure, what could possibly happen? He quickly fashioned a fake beard and a Groucho Marx nose and glasses out of toothpicks and a dead rat that he'd managed to capture. Well, it's, you know, you skin the rat with the paperclip.
Yeah.
Then you fashion the skin of the rat, the fur of the rat. Mm-hmm. You just, you with the paperclip, you just jab a little hole in it, like a mouth-sized hole.
Right.
And the blood is sticky enough that you paste the sticky rat flesh on your... Well, you might need to know this. Well, the way the US is going at the moment.
I need this.
It's about to collapse. We're going to talk about this on the bullshit filter later today, but it's about to collapse into, like, just civil war over there.
Right.
You might need to know how to disguise yourself with rat flesh, so I want you to listen carefully.
I'm listening.
Then you paste the rat flesh over your face. You might need something... You might need to come up with something that's like a glue, something that's sticky and viscous.
Give me a second. Give me 20 seconds.
Do you need me to talk about Russian schoolgirls again for a minute?
It wouldn't hurt. It would just speed up the process. And done.
Getting stabbed with a long, hard lance. You stick that over your face, and, you know, most people in dim light...
Right.
No, you know, can't tell the difference between that and a real beard. Anyway, he managed to jump onto a different train, and later on it stopped and a cop got on, a gendarme got on, and asked him if he'd seen an escaped prisoner. And he replied in fluent Russian that he basically said, "Нет, comrade, нет. Did my Stalin prison? Нет, my friend. No, I have not seen him." And the guy said, "Oh, thank you very much, comrade. By the way, I like your beard. It is very fashionable.
What do you call it?
Rat beard. I call it the rat. It's a very interesting style. It's not the big flourishy mustache. It's very thinly. I like it.
I catch on.
Comrade Hitler, I met him fighting against the Germans. He has a very small one, but I like your big one. It's very nice. Couple of days later, his train was stopped and boarded by an armed mob. They announced they were Bolsheviks and that the Bolsheviks had taken over the country. This is November 7th, 1917. They're searching the train for fugitive members of the bourgeoisie. Josip manages to convince them that he's on their side. They said, "But you have a beard." He goes, "No, beard is not real."
Right.
And like Julius Caesar with King Juba, they pulled on his beard and it actually came off. Aha! Right. They said, "What's the white sticky stuff? Don't pay any attention to that." And he then spends the next 3 years fighting as part of the Red Guard.
Damn.
In Russia for the Bolsheviks. He ends up in Omsk, which had been retaken by the whites in 1918. He gets forced to go into hiding. Omsk, by the way, is right on the distant sort of border of Russia, on the border of Russia and... What's that? China, Mongolia. I don't know.
Way over there.
That's helpful, right?
Yeah. I thought it was to the south.
What's that? Kazakhstan. It's on the border of Kazakhstan today. So just a little bit west of Mongolia. But out, you know, on the
way the fuck boonies. Out there. Yeah.
Yeah, send the boonies. So he's sent out to Omsk. The whites recaptured the white army. He's forced to go into hiding. And he gets hidden by another beautiful Russian schoolgirl.
Oh.
He says to her, "Do you have any Slav in you?" She says, "No, I don't know." He goes, "Would you like some?" She said, "Yes." 17-year-old Russian schoolgirl.
.com.
Also a Bolshevik. What about Bolshevik Russian schoolgirl? That's
the name of my sex tape. Right.
Her name was Pelagia Bielosnova, a.k.a. Polka.
Out of polka.
Yeah, polka.
Yeah.
He's like, "Hey, what did you do?" "A polka." And they fell in love. But then the whites in Omsk found out about him and they were hunting him, so he had to flee. And he crossed over the border and fell in with a tribe of Mongol nomad horsemen,
God damn,
known as the Kyrgyz.
Right.
What do you know about the Kyrgyz people, Ray?
I just know they're on the nearby steppes, but that is all I know. Horsemen. But they do have a new motor mill, but I don't know anything about them.
Well, the Kyrgyz people are the people from which Kyrgyzstan gets its name. So if you look at your map of the world there, you've got Russia, you've got Kazakhstan to the south. To the south of that today is Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, all the stands. Then below that, you've got your Afghanistan, your Pakistan. So, yeah, the Kyrgyz people were this Mongol people, basically, that, nomadic horsemen. Been around for a long, long time. You may have heard of some of their famous people, the Scythians, Ray. The Scythians we've talked about in our old Alexander series. Right. It's basically turned into the Kyrgyz people.
Right. Intense people.
Yeah.
Is he the original Forrest Gump? Because I feel like this is like the fourth or fifth life that he has led. Different country, different language, but there's always a woman around.
Well,
good God.
Yeah, so he falls in with the chief of this tribe. Chief has got thousands of horses, 20 wives, 100 children.
Jesus Christ. Right.
And Josip learns to speak their language because he's a cunning linguist, as you said, and he gets a job. The tribe had recently acquired a mechanical mill to grind their wheat into flour, and they don't know how to operate it. He goes, "Let me look at that. Yes. Oh, piece of cake.
I got this. I got this. I got this, boss."
So they basically give him, he gets to travel with the tribe, and, you know, just to keep all their mechanic stuff. They think he's like some sort of black magic. He knows how to do all this shit. And they're so impressed with his abilities, not only to maintain the machinery, but his skill as a horseman, his leadership capabilities. He eventually becomes the second most powerful man in the tribe, second only to the chief.
Damn.
Like an amazing, what an amazing life this guy has. Yeah. Everywhere he goes, he's just, I got this. You know, he just blends in, takes over, reinvents himself.
Yeah.
And the chief wanted him to marry one of his daughters and stay with them forever. Now, of course, we're getting all of this, I assume, from Tito's own accounts. It's not like they tracked down, historians tracked down the chief of this tribe and go, "Do you remember this guy, you know?"
Oh, yes, I remember him. I wanted him to stay with us.
But it's a great story. The chief wanted him to marry one of his daughters and, you know, be his successor, stay with them forever. But bros turned him down. I must go. You know who he is? He's fucking a man called Horse. That's who he is.
Yeah. I was going to say Little Big Man, Dustin Hoffman.
Oh, I never saw that.
He had a bunch of different careers in one film. American Indian, gunfighter, tonic salesman. He had a whole bunch of different careers. And that's what he reminds me of as well. Tito does.
Oh, the only thing I remember of A Man Called Horse, Richard Harris film, 1970, is this scene where they put like spikes through him in some sort of, is it an initiation ceremony? He gets spikes with ropes and he gets pulled up into the air or something.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know.
It's a hell of a scene.
I don't know if that was an initiation ceremony or torture or what it was, but I can't remember.
Or foreplay. I'm not sure.
So bro says, "No, I'm sorry. I love you all, but I have a mission. I must go back to my people." But he learned their language, wore their dress. He's like Lawrence of Mongolia, basically, this guy. Like he just adapts in. Like to go hunting wolves with them, would sit around the fire at night drinking some sort of horse piss and telling stories.
Oh, the good old days.
He'd say, "I remember when I was a child in the tribe," and we would go and they go, "Dude, you've only been with us for 3 months.
You just got here." Previous
Listen,
life.
Don't let facts get in the way of a good story.
Shut up.
Eventually, somehow he gets news that the Bolsheviks have recaptured Omsk. And he returns, goes searching for Poker, and who had also had to flee because she was a Bolshevik, found her, poked her, married her.
Aww.
And in 1920, he and Polka Dot finally returned back to Petrograd and then back to his home country. He'd been away for 5 years.
Damn.
And he returns as a Bolshevik revolutionary, with a Bolshevik revolutionary bride, and he knows how to kill a wolf with his bare hands.
Tell me that's not going to be helpful. Yeah, he's ready to spread the word and bring the communist revolution to his country. He's seen it in Russia. It fucking worked there, even though it was messy. It's now time to bring that shit home.
Did you know anything about Tito? Have you covered him in your World War II show?
No. In fact, I got too many notes, stuff that, you know, little things here and there, just because I found it so fascinating. This guy was freaking incredible. Yeah. And he's still got a long way to go.
I knew nothing really about him apart. I knew who he was and that he reigned for 30 odd years, knew nothing about him. Yeah. I'm reading this story going, I was doing all my notes on a plane somewhere. And I'm like, fucking hell. I just wanted to talk to the guy next to me, but I was worried he had coronavirus.
Hey. Wake up.
Yeah. What an incredible story. Great story. As you say, he's only getting started. He's only like 25 at this stage. He's just getting started. All right. Well, but listen, as I said earlier, you cannot really understand Tito's story and the importance of what he did in Yugoslavia without understanding a little bit of the religious and ethnic history of Yugoslavia. And that is what we're going to do in our next episode. We're going to go back, baby. Back to the dawn of time, as we are wont to do. Future. But that will be next time, because...
You're not making any friends here.
Oh, I was thinking white people. Sorry, I feel bad now.
Has descended across the continent.
Two hammer. There's Pile Driver, the Sledgehammer.
Of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. The purpose of these bases... Can-